Welcome to The Doctor Is Out, a podcast hosted by Sharif Vakili, investor at Polaris Partners and primary care physician at Stanford. Join Sharif in exploring the extra clinical practice of medicine as he interviews healthcare leaders who have gone from bedside to build companies, run health systems, spearhead public policy, and pursue many other paths where they lend their unique bedside perspectives.
Our guest today is rheumatologist and the former CEO and Dean of Johns Hopkins Medicine, Dr. Paul Rothman. I am honored to present today's guest on the podcast. He is a brilliant rheumatologist, a molecular immunologist, and the former CEO of Johns Hopkins Medicine. Dr. Paul Rothman, it is a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Oh, Sharif, thanks for having me. I really am honored to be part of what is an illustrious group of folks that you've interviewed. So I'm happy to be considered among the people that you think worthy of your podcast.
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all, Paul. That's sweet of you. I'm excited truly to share your story with our audience today because you've had such a storied career through academia. I'd actually like to start with your roots. You grew up in Queens and you went to MIT for college. Came over to good old Yale for medical school. Can you share a bit about how you originally got into medicine and your journey to the field?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I actually went to MIT because at the time, this is in the late 70s, recombinant DNA was just becoming a thing. David Baltimore won the Nobel Prize for reverse transcriptase in the early 70s. And I thought MIT was one of the three places that was being known for microbiology. So I thought it would be a great place because I really was intrigued by that. And so at MIT, I worked for a wonderful man named Graham Walker on bacterial DNA repair systems and just got a real love for molecular biology. And so at that point, I had to decide whether I was going to go get a PhD or an MD. I thought that if I wanted to do molecular biology, I wanted to focus more on humans and try to see if I could use that technology to address human diseases. So I decided that probably be better to get an MD first. And that's why I went to Yale, because I thought that I could use patients to inform the decisions that I wanted, the questions I wanted to ask with my science. So that's what I did. And it's funny, the story how I became an immunologist, like most med students, you are both, you're overwhelmed by the material you're learning. Mm. And I was certainly, and it was during the January of my first year in med school that we had at Yale an immunology course that was taught really predominantly by two professors, Dick Gershon and a guy named Charlie Janeway. And Charlie was very charismatic, and he sort of looked like a Doonesbury, like Zonkers from Doonesbury, but was clearly brilliant. And I just found immunology to be fascinating, and Charlie became my advisor. And I asked him, I wanted to do human immunology, so he directed me to some folks at Columbia who were doing human immunology, a guy named Len Chess, who was a division chief of rheumatology. And it was really early on. I mean, he had one of the first fax machines, and he had the ability to have the access to the first monoclonal antibodies against surface proteins on human lymphocytes. And they were called things like OKT4 and OKT8, which were actually antibodies that recognize CD4 and CD8. And so I got to play around with faxes and I just got hooked pretty quickly. So,
wow, what an exciting time. What an exciting time. So you sort of brought your research longitudinally through college, medical school, and then residency, is that right?
Yeah. So I, so at Yale, we had to do a thesis, and I did that actually down at Columbia with Len, and then went to residency there because Len would, I knew would make sure that I got some solid training. And so I fast-tracked that. I did they don't have these anymore. It's something called a physician scientist grant, in which I had to do a fast track out of my internal medicine residency and my fellowship. So I did just 2 years of medicine and 6 months of clinical rheumatology, and then got into the lab of a guy named Fred Ault. And Fred was a molecular biologist and doing immunology and cancer research. And so I went to his lab for 4 years and did a postdoc with Fred, who was a brilliant molecular immunologist. And that's how I got started, and ended up staying at Columbia and setting up my own lab. So it was pretty neat. So I was both a rheumatologist and in the microbiology department. And really saw patients, rheumatology patients about, I did general medicine attending, actually. I've done that almost my whole career, a month of general medicine, and then a month of rheumatology, and then a clinic of once a week, and got up to a pretty big lab at one point, like 22 folks in my lab, and a lot of MD PhDs, and it was, and with some great collaborations there, did some neat work, the interesting story about my career path. So I'm a rheumatologist, and then the chair of medicine, I guess I was about my seventh year of faculty. He asked, would I become division chief of the pulmonary division? So I said, his name was Mike Weisfeld. I said, Dr. Weisfeld, I'm a rheumatologist, know that. He said, yeah, but my research sort of was focused on allergy and asthma at a very basic level. And he said, well, why don't you figure out what it would take to build a pulmonary allergy critical care divisions. So anyhow, so yes, I became head of pulmonary allergy critical care at Columbia, which I did for 7 years.
That would be so cool if we had such research fast tracks. I know there are fellowship fast tracks for MD PhD students now, but really being focused on research.
Mm-hmm. There are things called physician scientist training programs that a bunch of residencies. We had one at Columbia. I started one when I was dean at Iowa, and then I started one here at Hopkins when I became dean. So there are physician scientist training programs at many medical centers, and some of them you can fast track out. Some you can't fast track, but you get a cohort of people like you that you talk to from the way you begin. So there is an increasing understanding that to be a successful physician scientist, you have to sort of be, your career has to be a little bit tailored so that you can stay in science and still do your medical, your clinical training. So I think more and more programs are trying to think through how you do that, because, you know, physician scientist numbers have gone down. If you look at, for instance, who NIH funds, the number of MDs has gone down gradually but steadily over the past decade or two, and more PhDs getting funded. And, you know, there's MD PhDs who obviously get funded, but there's so few of them. I mean, it's, you know, 10% or 15% of most med school classes, so that to try to have that MD person stay in science is something I know a lot of medical centers are trying to address and try to figure out how you do that.
What are your thoughts on deciding between an MD PhD and a, you know, physician scientist program where you just do the MD and then you try to find one of these rare opportunities during residency and clinical training?
You know, it used to be more common, and they were called late bloomers. So you have early bloomers, many of which, you know, do a lot of research on their career and then end up being MD PhDs, and the late bloomers who really only do MDs until they do their clinical training and their fellowship. And there are fewer and fewer of those late bloomers. On a personal level, there are a lot of things that go into that decision. You know, the MD PhD, it's 8 or 9 years now to get out of med school. And so depending on, the good thing is, in general, you walk out with no debt because it, in general, it's paid for. And depending on your family circumstances, that's really important, because I think if you walk out of your training with a lot of debt, you know, the salaries for physician scientists are a little bit lower than for clinicians. And so I think a lot of people get pulled to full-time clinical roles just because they have a lot of debt. And so So a lot of people do that so that they can do the science and not have this huge overlay of trying to think of their student debt. So depending on your family circumstance, it may or may not. I was lucky enough that I got out with an MD and no debt, which was really, I think, facilitative of having a physician scientist career. I think it's harder if you don't have those means to do it, and MD PhD might be a good route.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when you were at Columbia, faculty seeing patients sounds like a month out of the year.
Two months and one day a week. So not a, and that's sort of a typical load for a physician scientist. You do probably 2 months of attending, one in your specialty, one in general medicine, or two in your specialty, and probably have clinic half day a week. Mm-hmm. But some it's a little more, some it's a little bit less. It depends on the institution.
Was it your love for research that pulled you there? Was it your love for building a lab? How did you foresee this fitting? And then I'm going to get to my next question, because then you started to evolve towards more administrative roles. How are you seeing the story of your lab forming, and what drew you to that, and what was exciting you every day during that period of time?
Yeah, sure. That's a good question. You know, I think one of the advantages a physician scientist has is that you are seeing patients, and and that you, in some way, the questions that you're asking can be affected by the patients you're seeing. So I always thought that was one. That's why, again, one of the reasons I got the MD, and I think that's true. And you know, I always, when I was doing my research, which was fairly basic research, I always try to do research at trying to understand at what points in a disease state could you intervene. So I studied very basic signal transduction of how cytokines work, but always at a direction of trying to understand how you might modulate the activity of cytokines. Especially for me, it was in asthma and allergy, so I studied a lot. My work was on IL-4, and we did a little work in cancer. Again, it was trying to understand pathways that are potential therapeutic targets for companies. And, you know, one of the things I did do even during my whole time at Columbia was we helped identify important pathways in allergy and asthma. And I worked with several pharmaceutical companies along the way, including Pfizer and Regeneron and Merck and Schering and others, to try to help them target the pathways you were studying for intervention. And it ends up that now both Regeneron and Pfizer have drugs that are successful and are treating patients in the pathways that we helped identify were important.
Wow.
So I think, again, I know PhDs do that too, which is wonderful, but as an MD, you're seeing the patients. And sometimes that's really helpful in directing the research that you undertake.
Yeah, that's incredible. You are clearly in such a remarkable field at a remarkable time, discovering really the foundation of, you know, so many of the drugs that we have today, and even honestly how the biotech pharmaceutical industry around immuno-oncology has blossomed, started in the work you were doing. Did you ever think that you would continue being academic, continue partnering with industry to translate the work you're doing, continuing seeing patients? Was there a point where you considered deliberately to pivot towards, I think you then afterwards were the dean of the University of Iowa, Carver College. Was that serendipitous? How did that process take place?
Well, I did. You know, I always thought translating your work into therapeutics was an important goal that I always wanted to do. And I did toy with going to industry when I was at Columbia at a couple points. But I decided to stay in academics because I thought I could make a difference. And I had two great mentors, Len Chester, who's head of rheumatology, and Kai Salakati, who was a wonderful physician scientist, was head of nephrology at that point. And they always said, since I had some some skills in administration that they were the two that always said, Paul, you should, you know, continue to do administration in academic medical centers because of your ability to both do science and understand some of the business aspects. So I did that when I was division chief, and then I had the opportunity to look at chairs of medicine. So, and I looked at a couple, and I ended up going to Iowa as the chair of medicine. Iowa had a great, and still does, has a great department of medicine. And Kais, one of my mentors, actually had started his career there, and he directed us. And my wife is a physician. She's a gastroenterologist, and she had a good friend who had done his training in Iowa City, and we just made the decision to leave New York and go to Iowa City and see. We had three kids and thought Iowa City might be a good place to raise them. I mean, we were finding it. My wife had at least an hour commute each way to see patients in Manhattan. I had probably half an hour commute. The commutes were just getting to us, and we thought that perhaps it would be a little bit easier in a college town to have a dual career in medicine and also raise our three kids. So we moved to Iowa, which we loved. We loved Iowa City. We loved the university. It's a great medical center. And being chair of medicine was a fantastic job, taking morning report. I actually still saw patients, and I had five people move from New York City to Iowa City for my lab to keep my labs going. So that was really helpful. And so I kept my lab going actually through my 8 years at Iowa, four as chair of medicine and four as dean. Kept my lab going, kept my funding. And we loved Iowa City. First of all, it's a great medical center. University of Iowa Health Center is a great center. Great people, really a lot of physician scientists. And we just loved the Midwest. We loved Iowa. It was a good people. And we were able to sort of more easily raise our kids there than we would have staying at Columbia. That's one of the reasons we did it. And it was, you know, right after 9/11 too. And it was, we thought time to try to something else. And so we were there, as I said, as chair of medicine first. And again, you know, I thought that was a job where I could keep my lab going and still see patients and still have a large administrative role where I just thought I could impact more people. And I really enjoyed that role. And then 4 years later, they asked me to become the dean. And so I did that there and really loved it. It's a great place. And I could still actually, I did stop seeing patients when I became dean. It just was harder because I found myself unable to see my patients because I had other calls on my time. And I thought that was unfair to my patients to have like a fellow go see them. I just thought that was not the way I wanted to practice medicine. So I dropped that. And then at a point in 2004, I had promised my kids that I wouldn't move them in high school. So in 2004, I had the two older, had my eldest, my daughter was already in college. My son was heading to college and my youngest son was going into high school. So I had this one time where I would live up to my promise to them. I wouldn't move them in high school. They thought that was a technicality, but I looked at a bunch of jobs and I got lucky that Hopkins came up and I was selected as the dean and CEO at Hopkins.
Wow. Before we go into that, I wanted to actually double click on something that you said earlier. First of all, go figure. So cool. A New Yorker coming to Iowa and really just thriving and loving it there. That's really cool. Another question I had was for trainees who are physician scientists or exploring that path and then see the industry path. And there's like different points at which you can sort of approach industry. Do you have any advice on how to guide that? What questions to ask oneself if it's a right fit, when and where, and who to talk to?
You know, that was a hard decision to make back. And you know, we're talking about the 90s. I think it's even harder today. And I see more and more physician scientists going to industry because the opportunities have just grown. I mean, the biotech field has exploded. And it's funny, one of the people who I postdoc with, a guy named George Nkopoulos, who is the head of research at Regeneron and has done really well. And so we talk sometimes because I sort of thought he said, why don't you come to Regeneron with me when he went up there? And so I've thought about it a lot. They're tough decisions. You know, when you go to industry, in some ways, if your goal in life is to, you know, ensure that you help make a therapeutic, it's going to be a little bit easier. Obviously, in industry, that's their goal. I think if you go into industry because you think you can do science and not have to write grants, that's the wrong reason to go. Because in reality, you know, in industry, you're going to be very directed at doing research that will end up in a therapeutic. And that might change, especially if you go to a big pharma, that, you know, the field changes and you have to drop what you're doing and just move to a very different area. And I've seen physician scientists who don't like that, who wanted to continue understanding basic mechanisms or the research they were doing. And if you think that's going to be you, you shouldn't go to industry, because when you go to industry, your job is to help make a therapeutic and not just to do science, but do very directed science, which will end up in a therapeutic. If you want the luxury of sort of going where your interest lies, then I think you're better to stay in academia. So I think that's sort of a fundamental decision. I used to say there's a little bit more stability in academia. You have things like tenure, but especially in the biotech, you never know how the biotech's going to go. But in these days, you know, the truth is, if you don't get funded in academia, you're going to end up seeing patients and giving up your science anyhow. So I think if you go to industry, it's because your goal in your career is to make a therapeutic. If that is your goal, then you should go to, you know, the industry may be a better place. You can do both in academia, and obviously a lot of academics have been able to do both. And academia gives a little more freedom to follow your instincts and and where you want to go than industry will. But so you can do both, but I think that's what I see as a major difference in the two.
Do you think seeing patients is possible just as readily in industry, or can that
be some people too? That is, I find that a lot of people who first go into industry, you know, try to do deals where they still see patients once a week or once, and a few people continue to do that throughout their industry career, but that's rarer than the person who goes, and because they get so busy with what they're doing for their company, they end up dropping the clinical stuff. I think that's much more common. And as you read away from the clinical work, you know, you just become very busy. And so I think you can do, but if you really love seeing patients, you probably want to stay in academia.
What about the leadership opportunities? Do you think those vary very much between the two?
I think both give you opportunities. I think you could do it in both. So I think that, you know, and, you know, leadership opportunities, you know, I've had, you know, the good fortune to be offered several of them over the years. And I know we're not at Hopkins. I always met with medical residents once a year and medical students, and they'd ask, so how do you become dean? Right? That's a classic question about how you become dean. But I still believe, in any career, that in academia or industry, the key goal is to be successful at what you're doing, and then people will seek you out. So it's never like I never thought my career path would be becoming dean or being CEO. I always thought that I would still just do my research and see patients. But I was successful at it, and then opportunities come knocking. So again, I tell students, just don't, and I know students, some are very ambitious and try to plot out their career path. I don't think that that's where to go. I think just do what you're doing really, really well, and then people will find you.
That's great advice. Absolutely great advice. Especially, I feel like medicine is such a long training path that you can start to like get in your head to try to control all these pieces. So I appreciate it hearing from you.
Yeah, no, I think that. And then some people ask, like, do you need an MBA? If you want to go to administration? Yeah. And
what are your thoughts on that?
In my time, no. Most of my peers who trained with me did not. That being said, when I look at what the people who are now moving into these type of positions, many of them do have MBAs. It's hard. It's really checking a box. I think if you a lot of the skills you need to be a successful administrator, you'll learn. You can learn on the job, and that experience is, I think, probably more useful than an MBA would be. That being said, in today's world, a lot of people are trying to check that box. Because the question is always, as you move from a research or physician scientist career to administration, does that person have the skills and knowledge to be an administrator? And, you know, if you have an MBA, a lot of people feel more comfortable that you've at least made the attempt to develop the skills you need. That being said, you can develop those skills in other ways other than getting an MBA. So,
do you feel like certain personalities might be more conducive towards administration and may not need the MBA, and others might? Like, is this a self-reflecting question or not necessarily?
Yeah, I don't, so that's sort of, I think some people have personalities that will allow them to be successful in administration,
sure,
whether or not they get an MBA, because if they don't have that personality, they can have two MBAs and they're not going to be successful. But
I guess I mean this too in like the terms of, you know, sometimes I feel like physicians in particular, the business community could sort of pigeonhole us to not have the type of personality that might be necessary in administration. Do you think that's an accurate statement at all, or have you encountered anything like that?
Yeah, I can understand where you're coming from, Sharif, but I don't think that's true. I think, as I said, if people have questions and they have the MBA, then those questions, at least the person had the desire to develop. And it's more skills and personality. An MBA is not going to change personality. Like, an MBA supposedly will provide you with skills that will be helpful as your administrator. And I think that's probably true. I got those skills when I was division chief at Columbia. I just developed my business skills and acumen. And but I can see your point that when you go to industry, you have the MBA to make them feel a little more comfortable. But that being said, your success in that administrative role will really depend on both the skills you develop and your personality and what motivates you. I've always thought that I've been motivated by the desire to help other people be successful. And that sort of is required to be a good administrator. And people who just focus on their own careers are a little less successful as you move up. Because as you move up, I was used to do, when I hired division chiefs, when I was chair of medicine, and the truth is, when I hired some department chairs, I would always give them the test. I said, you know, it's a day before a grant is due. You can reread your grant or read your assistant professor's grant. Which one are you going to pick up first? And if you have any doubt that you're picking up your assistant professor's grant first, you're not ready to become an administrator. That really, you know, when you take these administrative roles, it's because you are going to gather joy at seeing others be successful. And if your joy is from your own success, then you're not going to be a successful administrator in academic medicine. So that's sort of
like
what
that
you have to be thinking through.
Yeah. You're ultimately serving your community. Curious if you've ever encountered amongst any of your mentees or your colleagues as they transition from the physician role or physician scientist role, academic role, to some of these more administrative roles or industry roles, any sort of imposter syndrome and how to encounter or tackle that?
I'm not sure. How do you define imposter syndrome?
Imposter syndrome meaning like, you know, we feel like, you know, even though we've had so much leadership experience in our clinical training, obviously physicians are leading in many ways all the time. When you go into this new area and it feels like people, their personalities can be a little bit different in business, and the expectations, the culture can be a little bit different. You could feel insecure or as if you're not part of the club. And I don't know if you've ever encountered that. You've seen this. I feel like I've sometimes seen this in people who go to try to move from the physician route that they're used to into this other area that can feel just like the rules of the game are a little bit different, or the culture is a little different. What's respected is a little bit different. And you can make yourself feel scared or insecure.
I think everyone feels a little bit of that when you move up to take a position with a scope much larger than you've had, which will require different skills. I think everyone feels a little scared about that. If they don't, they should, because you do. I think it actually is motivating to feel a little bit that you probably don't have all the skills you need for the next role you have, and that you should try to understand what skills you're going to need to be successful and try to make sure that you acquire them. Because as you move up in any, if you move from academia to industry or up an academic path, you know, your scope of activities changes, and the skills you need are going to change. And I think you always need to be reinventing yourself. And you're always, I mean, you should be scared, because, you know, at some point, you know, Peter's principle will come in, and the potential that you will reach a position that you don't have all the skills to be successful in is always a possibility. And I think you always worry about that. And you need a little confidence, but not too much, because you do need to think that, yeah, I probably need to learn more to be successful in this role. And how do I develop those skills? And it often be a mentor that you have, or reading, or, you know, combination of the two of those, or taking classes, you know, as you move up, or getting an MBA, whatever it is. I think you always should think about that as you change the scope of what you do, you're going to need new skills, and you need to figure out. It's funny, my son, who is a computer engineer out in San Francisco, not too far from you, he's at a startup, and he's moving up, and he's now be taking managerial roles. And so over, you would like this. So over, when he came to visit in June, I gave him a stack of books on, on basic skills that you need as you become a manager and a leader. And he was very thankful to have to lug them. I had to actually have to ship them. He couldn't carry them in his backpack. He was had too much weight. So I shipped them out to him in San Francisco so he could start reading them. And, you know, it's how to handle difficult conversations, how to just an array of skills that you need to develop. And you know, there are a lot of ways to do that. Now you can do them, you know, online classes, or you can read, or, you know, you just rely on your mentors to help you develop those skills.
I love that, Paul. That is so uplifting, and such great advice. Such great advice. Now I'd like to actually ask about your role as CEO of Johns Hopkins, which is where we first met. I remember when I was a medical student and you came and you spoke to us. What was it like in that role? How would you describe that job description?
Yeah, so that's good. So it's a dean and CEO. So I'm dean of the medical faculty and CEO. Mm-hmm. So the Johns Hopkins Medicine is an entity that has both the health system and medical school, which are actually two separate legal. And it's a huge job. I mean, last year we had $10 billion in revenue, six hospitals, a large primary care base, the medical school, and then we have an insurance company, an international division, and a home care division. So it's about 50,000 employees. So it's quite large. But it's sort of neat, because if you think about it, we have an insurance arm which really helps inform our delivery system, and we have a delivery system which helps inform our insurance company. And the international division was neat. You know, we help manage a joint venture in about 15 countries around the world, from Saudi Arabia and Lebanon and Turkey to Brazil, Chile, Peru, to things in China, and And so that's really neat. And trying to learn how medicine is practiced around the world. And so it's a large job. And one of the things I always tell people, Sharif, as you move up from a division chief to a department chair to a dean to a dean CEO, you know, one of the things that you, a couple, I think, things are essential for success. One thing is effective communication. And that's sort of, I find, the hardest thing that I've had a hard time because, you know, if you're a division chief with 40 faculty or 20 faculty, it's pretty easy to communicate. When you come department chair, you know, with 200 or 300 or 400 or 500, and then dean with, you know, 500 to 1,000, and then dean CEO where you have 50,000 employees and 3,000 faculty. How do you communicate? And that's a real challenge. It's one of the oxymorons of our world today because we have so many means to communicate that you think, but I actually think it's harder to be effective because we all are so bombarded by information on a daily basis. We have this thing that we carry in our pockets, buzzing you with information all the time. And, you know, you're just bombarded and everyone develops filters because our brains can't both monitor and interpret all the data and information that we see, you know, on a daily basis. So we develop filters for what gets through, you know, because how many emails you get a day? I mean, I'm sure, you know, everyone gets 100, 200, you know, as dean, I'd get 300 or 400, you know. So how do you filter them? How do you decide what's important, what's not? And when you're running large organizations or even a department with, say, 250 faculty or 300, 400, or 50 faculty, how do you effectively get that message? And I think what happens is, at least my generation, you could self-deceive yourself and say, I sent the email out, everyone read it, so everyone knows what I'm on or what we're thinking of doing. And the truth is most, you know, you at best 30% of people, at best 50% open your email, 30% may read your email, and 20% may actually take the time to try to understand it. And so you have to sort of develop multiple means of communicating effectively. And if it's emails, if it's podcasts, if it's, you know, go on social media, you know, LinkedIn, Twitter, or if you actually, believe it or not, hold in-person meetings.
Right.
Or Zoom meetings, you know, you have to, I think, and print. One of the things that we came to realize over the pandemic was that we have a lot of our employees, when you're 50,000, especially the lower paid employees, they don't read, they don't look at email. It's just not in their realm. They use social media and print. And so you have to think about how you're going to get messages out to all of your folks. You know, we wanted everyone vaccinated, and we found out that most of our local employees, the emails, some didn't even have access to email, you know, let alone reading them, let alone. So you had to try to do, and they don't have Zoom, and, you know, they don't have, so you have to, you know, get there in person, print, I mean, all of those things. And, you know, you have a lot of people who work night shifts. And so it's really very hard to be effective. And I think that's the first thing, to be effective as you move up ladders, communicate. And the most important thing as you move up in your career is how to go from being an operational leader to a strategic leader. And so you, when you run a division, or, I mean, you're really an operator. You know, you have this division, you have to make sure that patients are seen, that if you're in a procedural specialty, that the ORs are open, that your patients flow, that clinics run, that the grants go out, that the grants are administered, you know, very operational. As you move up, you have to become more and more of a strategic leader, because as dean CEO, if I'm not thinking strategically, who is, right? And it's very easy because you develop your leadership in an operational role to continue to think operationally and not strategically. And so I tell people, as you move up, sort of set yourself strategic goals, and then find some mechanism to ensure that almost on a daily basis, you're thinking about your yearly strategic goals, which should really be, you know, roll out of your 5-year or 3-year plan, whatever you're doing, but think of a yearly plan. And when I was chair of medicine, I'll never get this, at Iowa, the first, I finished my first year and realized that all I'd done was make sure that the tracks ran on time and hadn't really thought about enough about what the department needed to be in 5 years. And so as I started to do that, I had my yearly goals and I put them on my screensaver. I know people don't have screensavers as much anymore, but so every day I walked in and I saw what my goals for the year were. And just as a sort of reminder that I knew where the department needed to go that year to end up being where we wanted to be in 5 years. And because it's so easy to just ignore those and worry about the what was, because on every day something new is going to come up that you had to deal with that was very operational challenge for someone or issue. So it's very easy to get caught up in that and not think about the larger, more strategic goals that you have to make sure that your organization's accomplishing. And you have to figure out mechanisms to do that.
Wow, that is such helpful advice. And honestly, that really resonates even as I think about different companies and the roles in which the CEO needs to take as a company grows too. Did you find that being CEO of this enormous $10 billion institution with an insurance product, of academic faculty, international presence, home health, did you find yourself having to learn about a bunch of new industries in order to create these strategic plans? Or was your job more to listen to experts around here and sort of be the node? How did you navigate that?
Oh, it's actually both, right? So first of all, the other skill that I also think leaders need is the ability to listen. Because especially in academia and industry, you have a lot of smart people. I always believe in group intelligence, that in fact, the thing about a great organization, for instance, at Hopkins, is we have so many smart people that if you just listen and if you get all those great minds together to address problems, that group intelligence makes you a great organization. So I think listening is a good skill. But you did have, I mean, I knew nothing about how insurance companies work. And so I was able to learn that both from our insurance company, but also from, I got involved in, I think, the Aspen Group, where a lot of the big insurers participated. So I got to learn that a little bit. You know, same thing internationally. You have to go out and understand health systems in different places. So you can do that from different means. And it sort of makes it fun, right? You're learning, as I say, you're learning the whole way through. And got to learn, you know, how healthcare in India worked, which was very different from healthcare in the US and or in, you know, in Saudi Arabia. So you get to learn a lot, which is fun. You have to listen, go to meetings. You know, the nice thing is I got invited to go to a lot of meetings that were outside of just academic medicine, but you'd have insurers or other payers or, you know, industry. And then you learned a lot. When you try to, because, you know, in science or in, I think in any major job, that some of the great accomplishments will occur by cross-fertilization of bringing understanding from one industry or one scientific area to a new one. That's where a lot of the great breakthroughs happen. And if you're not out there either reading about them or hearing about them as a leader, I don't think you'll be able to do that. And so I think the more and more you get out there and listen to different industries, trying to bring learnings from those worlds to what you're trying to accomplish, I think the more you do that, the better leader you're going to be.
What do you think your flavor of leadership is like compared to if we were to talk to the CEO of another academic medical institution? Interestingly, for example, at Stanford, the CEO of our healthcare system, David Entwistle, is different from our dean, which is Lloyd Minor. Yeah. And it's set up a little bit differently. Curious if you have ever reflected on your own style, your own legacy. And do you think if I spoke to someone in who's run another academic medical system, they would be thinking through these questions and problems similarly.
That's a good question. And remember, Lloyd hired me at Hopkins. He was a chair of my search committee. He was a provost here. He was a provost here. And Lloyd's still a good friend. And I know David very well too. So you have great people there. You know, everyone has their own style. I think you have to be comfortable with who you are, and who you are will help lead to the style of leadership that you have. I think more and more to be successful, this idea of servant leadership is what you have to, what you need to be successful in the year 2020 or 2022 or 2025. I mean, I think you have to be a servant leadership. I think all successful leaders these days, the real top-down alpha male, the Jack Welch's of the world, that doesn't work with your workforce today. Your workforce today wants someone who's going to be a listener, who understands this idea that everyone brings value to the organization, and that a great leader listens and develops strategies around, both bring something to the table themselves. So it's gotten out there, listen, heard from other industries, but also is able to mold the strategy for the institution by what they hear from their own staff from wherever they are. Because in general, all of us are working with very talented people. And I think listening to what they have to say will make you a more successful leader. I think that's true of most successful leaders these days. I think that old alpha there's still a few of them out there, but much fewer than they were. I remember when I trained as a med, the chairs of medicine were these huge figures who were dominant alphas and ran their departments of medicine and the surgery department the same way. You had these huge giants in the field, and you just don't have that these days. That's not what your people want, and that's not how in today's world you can be successful.
That's really encouraging. Well, at least I think. And sometimes, honestly, I wonder about that exact question. I don't know if you've ever heard of this book by Jeffrey Pfeffer. He's a Stanford sociologist and business school professor. It's called The 7 Rules of Power. And he sort of knocks authentic leadership and is sort of more of the old school line of teaching. And it's encouraging to talk to somebody who's a real life example of the new world school of thought of authentic leadership and being a listener. And what Clay Christensen says, like level 5 leadership over the humility, so my second last question for you, Paul, and this has been such a rich conversation, thank you so much, is what's next for you?
Oh, I don't know. I have a sabbatical year. So I am, as you could tell, I'm actually out here at the University of Colorado, living in Boulder. I am at the bench pipetting.
Quite literally. I know the audience won't ever be able to see this Zoom background, but Paul is literally at a lab bench right now.
Yeah. And it's fun. I'm working in Tom Check's lab. He's a great friend and let me be in his lab. So I'm working on I train as a molecular biologist in Fred's lab, and I'm doing molecular biology and having a great time and just around a talented bunch of students and postdocs. And it's fun to go to lectures and hear science again and enjoying myself out here for the year. And I don't know what's next. I'm thinking through that. Actually, I had a call this morning and I have a call this afternoon. It's something different. After Hopkins is, and I know Hopkins is just a great institution. I don't think I could ever top being the dean CEO there. So I'm going to try to do something different, I think. And I still am on the board. I'm on the board of Merck, which is lovely. I'm on the board of the King Faisal Health System in Saudi Arabia. So still having some fun. And I'll see what's next. I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out.
It's amazing. Well, I can't wait to see what you do next. My last question, Paul, which we always end the podcast with, which is, Have you come across anything recently compelling or interesting that you might recommend for the audience? It can be absolutely anything, a book, a TV show, a podcast, a song, poem, anything.
I will say, I hate to say, but we live in a world of turmoil, and that I think is hard for all of us. There's been such churn in the country among, you know, you add to the politics, to the pandemic, that I'm actually believe in escapism at some level. I like reading. I read both nonfiction and fiction. I am in the middle of Jonathan Franzen's book, Crossroads, and I just read Cloud Cuckoo Land, which is a wonderful book by John Durer, who has written a couple of books I really like. So I like to escape when I read. Believe it or not, my favorite Netflix show right now is a Great British Bake Off, which I love to watch. And I'm not good in the kitchen, but I like. But you know, I'm reading. I just read this book, Lab Girl, which is a true story about a woman and the difficulty she had being a successful scientist, which was for me was very helpful, because it's so easy to lose track of how hard it is at an individual basis, especially for women to make it in science. I thought that was a good book. And I'm reading, so I like to read both. I don't think inspirational is, I don't think I've read anything inspirational. For inspiration, my wife and I hike a lot. So we're out in Colorado. One of the reasons we're out here is because we like to hike. We have a house in the mountains. And my wife has read several books that talk about the effects of outdoors and trees and forests have on human health. And so I think inspiration comes from being out in nature for me, and seeing the creation, this wonderful place that we have the privilege of being part of, and trying to ensure we protect it for future generations. Because it's funny, because my wife and I drove out here with our dog, and you know, and if you see this amazing country that we live in, and to think that the thing that we can try to protect it for our children and our children's children, because it is an amazing world we live in. So I just, as busy as I'm sure all your listeners are, because they're students and postdocs and residents, try to get out in nature and remind yourself, you know, what a wonderful planet we're on, what a wonderful world we're part of, it, and try to do whatever they can to help preserve it. I think it's something that sort of inspires me.
That does it for this episode of The Doctor Is Out. Thanks for joining us. If you have any suggestions, feel free to reach out to us at info@tdio.org.